Hey, Talkhouse listeners, it's Josh Modell. Instead of encouraging you to listen to podcasts today, I'm here to encourage you to read something great. The particular something I have in mind is the second issue of the Talkhouse Reader, the print zine spearheaded by our fantastic music editor, Annie Fell. This issue is focused on the intersection of food and music, and it features contributions from Maddie Matheson, Coleman Domingo, Squirrelflower, Sam Evian, The Blessed Madonna, and more. There are pieces about eating while on tour, the gentrification of food, cooking as a creative catalyst, and much, much more. You can order a copy today, along with the first issue, at store.talkhouse.com. Please do check it out.
Hey, Talkhouse listeners.
We're going to have a new president. Thank fucking God. Ah! Finally. Ah! Okay, having said that, we want to tell you about a podcast you might enjoy from our friends at Osiris Media. Past, Present, Future Live is a weekly show that dives into the minds and experiences of musicians like John Oates, Nicole Atkins, MC Taylor, Calexico, Larkin Poe, and many others. Each episode ends with a live performance from the artist as well. Check out the interviews and live performances at osirispod.com/PPFL. And now, here's our show.
Hi, this is Carrie Brownstein.
This is DJ Premier.
This is Darren Aronofsky.
You got the RZA right here.
Rose McGowan.
Right here.
Aisha Tyler.
A Tribe Called Quest.
Fred Armisen.
Fritz Paul.
Javier Munoz. Seth Meyers.
Frankie Cosmos.
Flying Lotus.
Hi, we're Haim, and you're listening to the Talkhouse Podcast. Ow!
Up. It's your host, Elia Einhorn. Welcome back to the Talkhouse Podcast. For today's show, we pair two virtuosic musicians who have a gorgeous new album out together. Guitarist Leo Kottke and bassist Mike Gordon, who may be best known as one quarter of jam band icons Phish. Leo and Mike released their third collaborative album earlier this year. That was back in August that Noon dropped. But on November 20th, the CD and LP finally hit stores. I'll be picking one up. Another man who I think will, joining us from Chicago, the city of wind.
It's Josh Modell, executive editor. What is up, Elia?
Hey, man. Thanks for joining for today's episode.
It's my pleasure. I thought in honor of these guests, maybe we should do like a 2-hour improv intro. What do you think?
I'm here for it, man. I've hit some Phish shows in my day. I'm here for the 2-hour intro, but I know the audience wants to get to the real deal here, not listen to you and I gab. So for those amongst our listeners who may not know his career so well, let me tell you about Mike Gordon. He is definitely one of the sickest living bassists. Mike is a founding member of Phish, who are undoubtedly, and I'm not being hyperbolic here, one of the most singular groups in rock history. Widely acknowledged as an heir to the Grateful Dead, the jam band has earned legions, and by legions, I mean millions of devoted fans for their sonically exploratory live shows. Now, on his own, Mike has released a handful of solo albums and collaborations, but Phish is still staying busy. Back in April, the band released their newest studio album, their 15th, if you can believe it. That was called Sigma Oasis. And his record with Leo Noon followed just a couple months later. Here's the lead-off track, Flat Top. That's hot, huh, Josh?
Yeah, man, that's awesome.
Brilliant stuff. Josh, tell us about Leo, man.
Yeah, man, Leo Kottke has been playing guitar for more than 6 decades.
Boom.
And at 75, before the pandemic hit, he was still playing tons of shows. But he's not a huge fan of releasing records.
Yeah, interestingly, the reason he stopped putting out records, he says, is because he didn't like the streaming model and social media. He just felt like it sort of undermined the process for him.
You can see why he feels that way.
Mm-hmm.
But going back into his catalog, it's pretty incredible. His very first LP from 1969, 6- and 12-string guitar, is considered a classic for fans of folks like John Fahey, who was a big fan of Kottke's early on.
And even released that record.
That's right, yeah. So for fans of that style of music, he's really at the top of the heap.
Yeah, Josh, Leo Kottke is your favorite guitarist's favorite guitarist.
Absolutely.
He's a legend.
And it's fun to hear Mike and Leo talk about technique a lot, which they do in this conversation.
Yeah, man, they get into a lot here. I mean, we get both Leo and Mike's superhero origin stories, which is awesome. A little hint, one involves a swimming pool, the other, a trombone.
We get to hear what the Grateful Dead's Bob Weir taught Mike about rock and roll.
And the book that Trey Anastasio recommends. They also get into what it's like working with producer Jared Slomoff.
They talk about music as a drug.
And loving the musical Unknown.
And finally, an inspiration and proposed direction for their next collaborative album. Check it out.
Let's do it, man.
All right.
Okay.
Do we start talking now?
Let's start talking.
Yeah, let's. I have a question.
Sure.
A long time ago, you told me about being in a pool and hearing a bass player. Am I right? Or is that?
Yeah, that's exactly true.
Now, at the time, you were playing bass? Or were you?
Not yet. That was my inspiration right there and there.
Okay, yeah. That's what I wanted to know, because that's central. There seems to be every great player that I hear of or that I run into.
They have a moment, an epiphany?
They can point to a point.
Oh, yeah.
Were you playing anything before the bass?
Yeah, I had been playing piano, some piano lessons, and a little bit of guitar.
Ah, okay.
And I had been to a couple bar mitzvahs where I heard live bass. That was probably the first time. And I was cueing in on the vibration part, but not really registering consciously that I enjoyed that until I was in the pool. Ironically, that was in the Bahamas on the same island that you and I went back to prepare the material for 66 Steps.
Back to the pool. And you met...
down the street.
Didn't you meet that guy, bass player?
I didn't meet the bass player. It was the band called the Mustangs. And the singer was John Boy, so I met him. He had 75 silver necklaces and a huge afro. It was like 1977. And I was in the pool, and I said to my dad, I pointed to the bass, and I said, if I'm ever in a band, I would like to play that instrument. And he said he agreed. If he was ever in a band, he would like to play that instrument. Because I like the vibration part.
Oh, yeah. And you still do.
I do. That's why it was funny that I was reading... Was I reading or just hearing you in one of our interviews done separately about maybe what Buell Neidlinger said, that bass is to be felt, not heard?
Right. Yeah. He said, no, you shouldn't hear the bass. You should. It's there. And if you take it out, you miss it. I forget his exact words, but it's the same. Yeah. The vibration.
Well, the ironic thing about that is I totally agree with him. And when I play with Fish, when I play on a louder stage with drums and everything, I go for 90% feeling, vibrating all the parts of my body, the spleen. And I don't like to get as much in the ears. I'm sure it's plenty. But so when you said you were sort of adapting to getting used to someone out front sonically, I was thinking, why in the world do we have me out front when I like bass as vibration? Let's just remake these three albums and start again. Because I love the feeling part. A little goes a long way.
Yeah.
I mean, when you and I were playing with no monitors and no amps, I was getting feeling. I was getting what I needed.
Yeah,
it's all relative.
I was too. But we should maybe mention, because there are people listening in, that we had, I know of two nights. One was at the Jammies and one was at Red Rocks, where we were tight as a nut when we were playing, but we wound up having played a beat and a half apart through the set. You remember that?
Well, no, but I believe it.
Yeah, we were right there.
I know that experience.
A beat and a half apart. It's one thing to be a beat and a half apart, but to be able to maintain that exactly said
right.
something.
A whole concert of one and a half beats apart.
Yeah,
that's a new
accomplishment.
Feat.
You know,
yeah.
That's a
no one does that anymore.
We need an award. Yeah, no one. That's right.
Try to do that, Joe Pass. I was just flashing back to. I joined the high school jazz band just for the last year, and we had a guest conductor just for the last semester, Diego Poprakovich, who led the Harvard Jazz Ensemble.
Great name.
And we had these jazz combo meetings at night with the lights completely off, and Diego, this long hair, just jumping up and down. We were playing Manteca, the Dizzy Gillespie thing, and stuff like that, a 20-piece band. And I couldn't keep the beat going for the life of me. And the entire time him conducting meant looking at me and going, 2, 4, 2, 4. And I was thinking, but how do I get the 2 and the 4 on the upbeats? I'm seeing that as downbeat. He said, I don't care what note you play. You could be like a half step off from us the whole time, as long as you've got your time figured out. I was like, well, the time is the thing I don't have figured out, so...
T-Bone Burnett said that to me. I don't care if it's out of tune. I care if it's late
yeah.
or early. And I think he's right about that. I think they're both right about that, don't you? Was it John Lennon's favorite rock and roll 45, what they used to call a girl group? And they're way out of tune, and it's a mess, and it's badly recorded.
Yeah.
But it's just right, because they're all at the same time.
One thing that reminds me of is when I had my brief stint with Dead & Company and Bob Weir and the two Grateful Dead drummers and John Mayer, and Bobby stopped everyone to say, you know, rock and roll is about the swing and the straight. That people say rock and roll means this sexual thing, but yeah, but the term comes from straight being put against swing, and especially with these Elvis recordings where the drums were straight as hell and the guitar was swung, maybe I'm getting it backwards, and they're not doing the same thing, but it's that that created the rock and the roll, and how all the new band, like the Beatles got that and the Rolling Stones, but so many newer bands don't get that.
Huh.
And it's funny too, because when I listen to you and go to your shows, I hear a lot of what I think of as being sort of a straight groove, a lot of the Train groove, it's constantly varying. So this is just a terrible stereotype. I'm putting you in a tiny pigeonhole. But when we play together, it goes the other way toward the sort of swung thing. And I wonder if there's something about us that makes us the greatest rock and roll band ever, because that we can put rock, the swung and the straight together without, I have no idea.
Well, the first day that we went to the barn, and it was a terrible day for both of us. Neither one of us was happy. And at the very end, you were packing up, I was about to, and I played a little figure, just a figure. You said, what's that? And after the whole day convincing us that we couldn't make this work ever,
yeah,
we knew with just a bar or two that we could, that we yeah. did. And I think that must be what happened. And we recorded that thing. We wrote that together. I've forgotten the name of the tune.
Did it become June or something? Maybe
June.
We were in the barn in June?
Yeah.
Possibly?
I think that might have been the name we gave
it. It's weird how the tiniest thing can be a portal. And for us, yeah. it was sort of the portal of our relationship and our career.
Exactly. Exactly. The whole thing was there. Out of that, we could do anything. There seemed to be a handle that we had to have, and we couldn't find it the whole day. I mean, you remember, it was just embarrassing. And
well,
I wanted to hide.
Yeah, it was terrible.
Then we had the handle.
Let me ask you a question then to go. I want to go outside the box here. Do you have these experiences? You're mostly playing by yourself, so I don't mean with me, but where there's a kind of portal that's what I would call, not to use a heady word, but a religious experience, a spiritual awakening, an out-of-body experience, walking into a dream, all these things that I sometimes, a peak experience. Do you have that stuff?
I do have that stuff. Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, Paul Newman's The Alcoholic, Tennessee Williams, was an alcoholic, and he's, why do you drink? He said, for the click.
Mm.
It's the click. It's the click.
Right.
And that's why, I used to know this count. So something like 7 of the last 9 Nobel literature winners were alcoholics.
Mm.
They're very similar. It's a similar buzz, but the one you get from playing a bass or a guitar does not hurt you. You know, you take a drink, the drink takes you.
You get addicted.
But it's the click. I think the click is the same for both of those.
So that could be like what people say, X factor,
yeah,
or flow state,
yeah,
or stupid cliche words,
yeah,
like that.
So I do, yeah.
And then what does that feel like? Does it feel like the guitar is playing itself? Does it feel like you're in a dream? Does it feel like, what does it feel like?
All I can say is it feels right. It's as if I just, right now, as we're speaking, as if I just found out that I have 2 feet at the end of my legs.
Okay, so it's a real correctness.
God, you know, it's like you recognize. It's. I don't know what it. Maybe it's molecular. It's just a.
Who knows?
I mean, there's a literal. You can almost hear it. Well, you will if you're playing something and that happens.
Well, the cool thing about mentioning the 2 feet is that's something that would have seemed apparent. And I think what you're implying by saying that is there's a lot of stuff right in front of our eyes that we don't see.
Yeah. Oh,
including
yeah.
in a pattern or a rhythm.
Yeah. Somebody beautiful walks in a bar, a coffee shop or something. I don't look at the beautiful person. I look at the people looking at the beauty. That's where the fun is. That's where you see stuff you don't ordinarily see, which is someone dropping their mask.
Right.
I mean, we all have to have one just to get along. It's kind of the calling card, you know.
They're dropping their mask because they're observing.
Yeah, and they've got a kind of click happening. The click is, here's one of our species that's really tuned up. This looks really right. You know, we're wired that way, aren't we?
Well, according to this book that Trey had recommended that I read, The Untethered Soul, loosely based on Taoism, it's kind of like The Power of Now, but not quite. It's observing your thoughts. And in the book, they're saying that your own thoughts aren't you.
Oh, yeah.
They're just, at worst case, the unwelcome roommate. We spend our whole lives building up protections from all these scenarios we've imagined in our thoughts. Like, oh, she thinks I'm an idiot. Or, oh, we're not going to get the record deal. Of course, the record sucks. Or, you know, whatever it is, constantly. And that in reality, those aren't us. That we're the observer just watching it. And same with feelings. You can watch your heart.
Yeah.
And if the people in the bar are watching the pretty woman walk in, maybe, if the book is right, they could see themselves as observers. Then they're reaching this outer.
I think so.
So yeah. When we left the barn that first time, you offered something that I thought was true. You said, well, I think what people like about my playing is that as soon as there's a pattern, I surprise them and change the pattern. Now, that's maybe my words, but you had words like that.
That definitely, I agree with myself.
And I agreed with yourself too.
Yeah. And I don't change it for them. I change it because from the very beginning, I wanted to hear something beyond the pattern. And the very first pattern that I was shown, and I was only shown one before I could even play three chords, was open-ended. And that was a great gift. I don't know who this guy was. He was a total stranger. And he came down a hall playing this figure. And it didn't end. So it left everything open. And I have a book with aforementioned books called The Sound of Surprise. I think Nat Hentoff wrote it.
Wow.
It's about jazz. But what you just mentioned and what I'm agreeing with is that you need that surprise where you build up, you feel it yourself as you're playing. You know where you're going and you can't wait to get there. And on the way, you find out there's somewhere else, and you go there instead. And to violate your own expectations is really great. It just feels tremendous. And I love music that does that.
Yeah, I do too. But because I've thought about you saying that for the whole 20 years, and we haven't talked too much about it. So you were taught some pattern that was something like the Travis, what is it, picking something standard-ish.
Yeah, well.
Oh, no, because it cycled. It did not repeat.
Yeah, it doesn't repeat. It's thumb, pinch, index.
Right.
That's what it is.
I can hear that.
And, I mean, you can compare it to the artery, the blood's gone. There's no good way to...
I know what you mean, though. I mean, it sounds like one rhythm over another, or like with banjo rolls, because you have three picks playing banjo, or you might with your thumb, index, and then the two together, or whatever it is, three playing over a four rhythm, it's going to cycle somehow.
Yeah.
Maybe that's not specifically what's happening, but it always ends up catching up, falling back, or... I learned these banjo rolls when I took lessons, and there were some basic rolls. But later, when I took lessons from my friend Andy Cartoon, he was saying, they'll just go forward, 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 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. And if that's not going to go in the bar line, it's going to keep switching where the one is.
Ah. Oh, sure.
It's going to just keep. But anyway, what I really wanted to ask was, the reason that appealed to you, first of all, is that to just repeat over and over again would be cliche, boring, not living in the moment, not the real deal.
It's boring and it's repetitive, but you know, it's tautological. You know, I'm green because I'm green.
Right.
There's a name for it, which is dead thumb.
Just predictable.
And there are great dead thumb pieces and great dead thumb players. We got to get that disclaimer in there. But if that's all you do, it's dreadful. It's like you're going to get your vaccine, but all you're getting is a needle. It's like that.
It's a placebo, musical placebo.
Yes.
And then on the other end of the spectrum, it's the unknown.
Yeah, yes.
If you don't know if this soup is human brain soup or some Mars space rock soup or...
Yes, exactly, yeah.
So you and I love the unknown. I like to find it in baselines. I like to go for a drive. And, well, I wouldn't say this about you. I like to go for a drive and not know where I am. I like to be disoriented because I love the unknown. But for most people, and for me sometimes, the unknown is the scariest thing ever. To sit down and work on a new song or something that's unknown, it would be much easier to just answer emails and you know, just dumb, stupid logistical emails because that's known.
I think you're describing another way to recognize the mind operating and to step away from it. By recognizing it, you are away from
right.
it. And that...
Exactly. By and watching
that is mind. That is where music happens, I think.
Yeah. Well, that's, according to these books, it's where we become universally connected. We're outer observers. Anyway, so as a bass player, I can't be too regular with you or it sanitizes what you're doing, defines it too much. But mm-hmm. if I'm too noodly and I'm not anchoring it, then it doesn't help either because then it gets lost and we're both being too random at the same time. So how in the hell can you deal with a bass player like me that's so varying and not traditional? You must have been used to more traditional bass roles.
Well, I worked a lot with a bass player here in Minneapolis named Willard Peterson. And he played more to the prescribed end of the spectrum for the bass than to the looser end.
Right.
To the horn end, you know, right. where right. you're a yeah. horn. But there are two mics, in my experience.
At least.
Yeah, yeah. And one of them is the one that when we were in the barn or at your house or wherever we are, and we'd sit down and play where there's no sound system, no recording. I refer to that when I get a little lost between us. I refer to that because mm-hmm. I know that happens in the instant when we're doing it and we are managing to balance all of this that you just described. Not managing, it just happens, and it's what yeah. makes it fun. And in the studio, you know how these places are.
Yeah.
It can be harder to find that
right.
because we have to think of other things. There is more thought.
Right.
Which
we have
is
goals
always
and songs
too bad.
And takes
yeah.
and yeah. sound.
So now it took us a while with Ants because I couldn't remember exactly how it went half the time, but I knew we'd get there because we always get there if we just
yeah.
sit out and play. What I'm really doing is not trying to find out how the two of us could play together, but rather how the two of us can play in a studio.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we got there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this album sounds to me, it feels to me like us sitting there somewhere. I keep picturing like a little ski lodge in Wyoming where there's a little music venue that no one's heard of and everything's wood and the stage is wood and it's tiny and we're sitting there and there's just five or six people. They're just drinking tea. It's like a little speakeasy or something. And it's, you know, John Fishman happens to show up like, oh, I've been camping around here. Can I bring my floor tom up and bang? And like, sure, of course you can
yeah.
for a few songs. That's the feeling for me much more than the other. I love the other albums for their in different ways, but this is the one I was so happy and with Jared's help and everything that we got a sound of us in a room.
Yeah. You were talking about that when we first started getting our toe in the water, oh, 2 years ago. And it's there, yeah. And Jared, you know, Jared, we should mention Jared.
Yeah.
Because speaking of watching and seeing, early on, you and Jared have a language.
Yeah.
And it's the language where you're not really saying much.
Right.
But you know what, after listening for a while, I can kind of tell
that's so funny.
What's going on. And it was the thing that made the studio work.
It made it, I know. And well, for people who don't know, Jared and I have been, it's the amount of time we've spent. We've been making albums
sure.
and things like that, soundtracks for 20 years.
Yeah.
And so, well, you think of this telepathic relationship that happens with people that you get on stage with, but Jared and I have had that in the studio. And so I wasn't thinking of it until you said that, but that's true. This understanding that sort of like doesn't need to be spoken. But I think you have a bit of that with Jared too, because he needed to understand that there were some frustrations in the way things were rough mixes were and things were being handled. And it's so, people might not understand what the studio is. You started to explain it, but early on, someone said, back when tape was rolling and magnetic tape, and some producer said, you know, it's kind of like you have this emotion, this heart and this soul to put out, and a funnel where you have to pour so much of it into this funnel because only a tiny bit is going to end up on tape. You have to like cram more than your heart. You have to squeeze your heart out of your chest till there's none left and then some to get anything on tape that's got emotion to it. And then you're facing technical shit and musical questions.
And you're in there in the studio and your heart's on your sleeve. It has to be. Coming out the end of that funnel, shrunk to whatever it is that can get out, and you're there. And at the same time, and this is where Jared comes in, you have to exercise real social skills because everybody else's heart's on their sleeve.
And
it gets sensitive.
Right. Definitely.
And all these old habits come up and
you can
stuff.
Throw your guitar against the wall. And I just read a book where that's happening constantly. Where someone threw a guitar at a stool at Bob Dylan.
And Jared is a great babysitter.
Because he's a people person.
You know, I'd get my frizz going somehow and there'd be, he'd have an angle over here that would make me happy.
I remember you were staying at my house one of the times we were working out tunes and I was saying, you know, we should have a producer. And at one point we thought we're not going to have a producer. Jared kind of was already involved as an engineer type, but and I remember you were just walking to the guest room to go to bed and we were both half asleep. And I was like, you know, I know these guys that are real indie hipster, blah, blah, blah. And they're so good and so interesting. And, you know, not to have something current would almost date us. And you gave me a sort of an eye roll and you're like, well, I got to know the person. Let's just know the person. And you were so right that like, in terms of like the hotline where you dial an indie producer to get some cascading tubular bells in the background is not the necessary way to make an album when you've got the telepathic thing going.
Yeah.
This show is brought to you by Patreon, who ask, creators, are you tired of being paid in clicks and likes? Social media and streaming platforms help people find your work, but getting you paid is another story. With Patreon, you can stop rolling the dice of ad revenue and per-stream payouts and grow your creative career through the direct support of the people who care the most, your fans. Since Patreon is built for creators, not advertisers, you'll skip the middleman and develop a sustainable income source by offering a recurring membership to your fans. In turn, they'll get access to exclusive community, premium content, and the chance to become active participants in the work they love. The creative system is broken. So if you're a podcaster, video maker, musician, writer, illustrator, a creative person of any kind, sign up on patreon.com now. That's patreon.com. And change the way your creativity is valued by building the steady income stream you deserve.
Well, let me just, I want to return. Sometimes when I have these conversations, we both go on so many tangents, or you on stage, or which is beautiful and the best thing in the world. But I try to check myself and not to leave something where there was later I'll realize, oh, but then what? And so the mic that you were saying is the one sitting on the couch where we're not in a studio. Mm-hmm. What is that mic? Am I just listening harder? Or am I just more relaxed, not self-conscious? Is that the only the difference?
Let me give that a little bit of a pause, because I haven't tried to define that.
Yeah,
I think it may just be everything we just described about studio. And the funnel, because I mean the studio is its own reality, but the reality of it is really what happens when we're just facing each other in a room somewhere, and that is one mic. He doesn't disappear. But he has to wear all those other hats later on. I don't know what my hat is, except that I get deafer in the studio than I am in a room. So.
Well, when you're playing all day in our backyard, to me it sounds like a concert. You always have a focus, which is interesting because you talk about how you've never practiced and you just play, and that's baffling. Well, okay, let me ask you this. I made this movie you probably don't even know about, called Rising Low, where I interviewed 25 top bass players, rock bass players, on film.
I remember hearing about it a long time ago, but I have not seen it, no.
And one thing I asked them, and the editor, Sari Bylander, who was a big influence, big help for me. It's hard to make a story out of a documentary because you're just taking random footage and you're trying to give it meaning. And my story, one of them, was why these bass players were the notable ones. You know, and I asked them, John Entwistle from The Who, you know, these people who are top echelon. And I said, were you in the right place at the right time? Did you practice harder? Do you have more influences? Did you find your own sound and reject your influences? And, you know, what is it? And usually they didn't know, but I've got to say, okay, we played at the Telluride Bluegrass Festival one time, and I was standing back there, and my heroes were there. Scruggs was standing there. He's probably 80 years old or whatever. And Jerry Douglas and Albert Lee. Now, Scruggs is considered the name in banjo, and Jerry Douglas is the name in dobro, and Albert Lee, the country guitar player, and there was you, and you fit perfectly in that because, for me, you're the guy, and I'm not trying to gush too hard or anything. But there's other great people who do fingerstyle guitar. But why do you think, and you probably won't be able to answer them more than the other guys did, but why is it you? Why is your relationship to the guitar such that you're the guy who carved this path that everyone said, well, was everyone trying to be more derivative and selling out?
As you mentioned, I don't really know, but I have a guess. As a matter of fact, I know this is involved. And that's why I asked you if you played anything before you heard the bass from
right,
the pool.
Right.
Is that I got the trombone, and I had it. I started on a violin when I was about 5. I don't remember that, but I remember that when I quit, because I went into a basement in Cheyenne, sat down in front of a music stand that had no music on it, with a bunch of other kids no taller than me. You know, we're about 3 inches tall, and there was a conductor. I got in late. I was the last kid to sit down. He gave us our downbeat, and I thought, where's the music? You know, we didn't have any. And I had time to look, and no one had any music, but he wanted a note. We gave him a note. And I wish to God I could hear that again. It was a basement full of little tiny children just making, okay, here's your note. And it was a sound, you know, that was really valuable. The next thing that happened was a lifetime was the trombone. And when I found the guitar, it was the first time I'd heard a chord other than on a piano or in an orchestra or something. I've just always wanted to go there, and it was not to play horn lines. And that's probably the big distinction is I did teach myself, and I didn't have the chance to play with other people.
Yeah.
So I developed that way. But a lot of it I still am just amazed that you can do more than a line.
Right.
And
well, in your case, more than two, probably.
Yeah, sometimes. But when I've gotten to play with Jerry, I'm sure you have, and I don't know how to do that stuff. That's the challenge for you when we're playing, is I can't, a little bit, I've learned how now. I sat in with Iris DeMent recently, And I remembered, Leo, be a horn, you know, just stop that right hand and just play something that, listen and stick something in there. I really liked it on the first tune. The second tune, it failed. But anyhow, I think it's the trombone.
But playing with other people, it definitely takes listening. And at one time years ago, you said, I don't do this much. And you even said something, this is going to be a real paraphrasing, something about how you don't really improvise in that way. I don't know if you said that, but you certainly do improvise because, I mean, even if you've never heard a song, you can play an E and constantly surprise yourself.
Yeah.
You have enough way to get around in more than one little melodies, little bass lines, little middle parts to dance around.
Yeah. It turns into a piano, I think, with my right hand.
Yeah.
Where I wish I could think more with my left hand. But I got to give you a quote. This is self-serving, but not really, because I just love this. I opened for the Mahavishnu Orchestra on their first tour, and about halfway through that tour, and that was a blisteringly surprising band, and just drove people crazy. And
nothing like it. Yeah. And one night I was trying to say to John McLaughlin, you know, again, how much I loved his playing.
Yeah.
Everybody in that band, but John was, and I was stuttering, and he said, your right hand means as much to me as my left hand means to you.
Well, all you need to do is just play one guitar at the same time, then and you're all set.
That's right. exactly.
You didn't have a piano in the house when you were growing up.
I did. Oh, my mother had a piano around, but I did not like the piano.
So you didn't play it. You didn't toy with it.
Right. I did not. I mean, I would sit down and poke it, but it never touched me. Horns touched me, and the guitar touched me real hard.
You told me at one point that you had these mini affairs with other instruments, like loving the banjo or mentioning the pedal steel.
Yeah.
You even said a similar thing about writing books, that these are all things that you could invest time in, but you chose always not to because you knew it would take you away from 6 and 12 string guitars.
Yep. Yep. That's changing. I write.
Well, it's changing because now you're writing and thinking about something. But I always thought of you as being an excellent example of someone who just focused on a thing with laser beam. And on the other end of the spectrum, I think of someone like Steve Martin because I feel like he's had 10 different outlets. He writes for The New Yorker. It's side-splittingly funny and informative. And then he has a bluegrass band and he's a stand-up comic. He was a magician. He's in movies. He's written plays. And he seems to do all of them well, from what I can tell. So it seems like there's more than one path. There's laser beam focus or there's let's do a million things. Is it your personality that, I mean, do you think that what would have happened if you had gone into banjo for a year and just... What would that rabbit hole have?
I did. I tried.
You did.
I tried to play banjo for 3 years and failed, and I concentrated on it.
Mm.
When I got back to the guitar, I mean, I never abandoned it. But when I got my feeling back to the guitar, it was right there, and that is that the guitar cured me when I first got it as a kid. I'd been sick a long time. It hit a spot that was left. The rest of me was gone. I think I was in real bad shape. And it hit a spot, and that spot brought me back to life.
Mm.
So it gives you focus because it's your lifeline.
Right.
And I hesitate to say that because it sounds exaggerated, but I have a feeling if I'm not unable to play the guitar at some point, I'll just wind up back in bed and die.
Mm. Well, we'll just make sure a guitar is attached to you.
Yeah.
If you end up in like a momentary coma for a few hours, we'll just make sure you're playing throughout that experience.
I watch you play, you have real good application, the way your hands work. You mentioned Joe Pass. You can't see what he's doing.
Mm.
You can't see what you're doing, except that everything's perfectly placed.
Mm.
And there is no contortion at all.
Hmm.
You're following your geometry, your personal geometry. And there's no, I think I'm right about this, there's no nail on your right hand that maybe a little backup kind of nail.
Oh, when you watch me play guitar, you're saying?
Yeah, or bass.
Because with bass, I'm using the pick.
Excluding, of course, the plectrum.
Right. Huh. Well, that's great to hear.
And then did you grow into that? Like me, I got into picks because I saw Lester Flatt wearing a thumb pick, which was a wrong thing to do. But how is it that you develop your tone production, your geometry, your ergonomics?
Oh,
was it thoughtful?
Well, it started with, I had a mentor, Jim Stinnett. You know, for years he taught at Berklee School of Music, but I just found him through the grapevine. Actually, I found him from that conductor that we had, Diego Paprikovich, because at one point he said, so who's your bass teacher? And I said, Quentin Hodges. And he was great. He was from the local Sudbury Music Center. He always showed up wearing a black jumpsuit because he was going to go play in a cover band at 8 p.m. after my lesson every time. Boogie, Oogie, Oogie. Get down, Boogie, Oogie, Oogie. which I'm sure is one of your favorite songs too. Anyway. So Diego Paprikovich said, not anymore. I said, what do you mean not anymore? He said, Quentin's great. He said, well, we're calling Jim Stinnett. And he took me to the school office and he said, Jim, it's Diego. We're making a lesson for you with Mike. And it was great. It was life lessons. And he's like, Mike, pick up the bass and practice. Don't play what you played yesterday. Don't play what, you know, it was really like discipline. And not that I ever did that, because like you, I never practiced. But no, I did a little bit. But he really wanted my fingers to be four fingers on four frets. And we worked on the ergonomics, and that stuck with me. And later I started to realize it was really interesting to learn this Mozart piece on the piano that I had been taught once, where all the fingerings were in the music. And it showed that we weren't doing that. We weren't supposed to keep the fingers over the keys. We were supposed to just use the longest ones to reach the black keys. And it was like, oh, that's just easier. Ah. Like, we can just use the good fingers and the hell with the bad fingers. And I read that about Joe Pass too. He said, there's really only two or three kinds of chords, minor, major, dominant. Yeah. And he said, just make them easy. So they find this is maybe the best jazz guitarist ever, you know, and I know you toured with him, but he's saying, just make it so it falls under your fingers. You got enough to worry about without ergonomic trouble from your fingers. Just make it easy. So now I realize I don't always want to be four fingers on four frets. Like, oh, what if it feels good to squeeze them in? Or just kind of, sometimes I want to jump up with my index finger so I can mute with the other, you know, just whatever works. But I really appreciate you saying that.
Yeah, when you play, your finger is always in the right place. Whatever finger I might choose to look at, you have the feeling.
I exude that confidence even when I'm inside frightened for my life. Like, I'm going to go up here and smile like I know what the hell I'm doing, and I don't.
There you go. Like, goddamn right.
You said to me in the studio, one time I heard back a take of something, and I said, oh, there's some fret buzz on that. And you said, why the hell should I care about fret buzz? Like, I don't care about that. I was like, oh, really? But I'd heard about a lot of African percussionists who like there to be a buzz and flop and these sure. weird extra noises. And that redefined my way of thinking too, because a little bit of fret buzz or the sliding up and down the strings noise or whatever it is, other guitar players might make themselves so clean that they're not having that sense of adventure, seeking the unknown, and
there's texture. It's texture,
right?
And if you clean that up too much, you know, it's like, I don't know anything about painting, but I know I like brush strokes.
Right.
I like playing that's got brush strokes. Anything. And there's that story a woman told me about her grandmother who had a photograph hanging on her wall, or a painting, or whatever it was in a frame, a glass, and the glass had a big crack in it. And by the time she was old enough to ask her grandma, she said, why don't you fix that, the glass? And the grandmother said, the beauty is in the break. And I think she's right. Of course, there's such a thing as too much fret buzz. There's such a thing as, you know, somebody dropping dead in the middle of the tune.
Well,
or, you know.
The funny thing about you not caring about the fret buzz is you're so particular if there's too much 3K or some other things going on.
Oh, yeah. That's just pain control, probably.
Yeah, right. Huh.
But also, no, actually, I am picky about 3K, period. Yeah, I think in general.
Anyone who likes 3K is not someone in my address book.
Yeah.
I've just written them all off. if you ever want to meet and have a great conversation with me or Leo, then I suggest you take 3K out of your listening habits.
Yeah, bring a notch filter.
Let me ask you another one of these sort of lofty, big concepts that you might have to say shut up over. But, you know, there was this Grateful Dead documentary, six parts on Amazon that I enjoyed watching. And there's one thing that a couple of them said that surprised me, that they didn't ever want to have a legacy. All they care about is the moment.
Mm-hmm.
The managers were making sure there were filmmakers on their tour in the early 70s so that they could, because maybe they were going to break up for good and they just wanted to capture it. And Jerry Garcia would say to that they'd be in Europe and he would say to the camera people, you know, it's a nice day. We're in France. You could put the camera down and just walk in the woods.
Yeah.
We don't care about the darn film. So I guess, I mean, I'm asking this because it's a curiosity of my own anyway, but does it matter what's left behind? I mean, you must feel proud of the fact that you have albums that are legendary albums.
I wanted to make a record in the first place because I had some tunes piled up and I was going to forget them. I wanted to be able to forget them and move on. And I didn't think I'd make a job of playing. And Faye put out the first record. And so I had a place to go to
if I wanted to hear those again and if I forgot them. And that was that was how that started. And but it is the night itself that I like. That's
the moment.
That's it. That's it. Yeah. And it's and it is never the same night. I don't care if you reprint it. It's not the same night.
Yeah, and if you hear it back on tape or whatever.
Yeah, and I mean, what is a legacy? I mean, they die just like everything else does, so.
Yeah, well, in the Fish world, in my, the where I come from, it's really built on the moment and a moment that you couldn't describe in your journal later or tell someone about when it's a complete experience.
Yeah. Arthur Rubenstein talks about that in his autobiography. He calls it the secret current, and it's a terrible name, but it's accurate. And it's in there before whoever walks on stage. It's there.
Yeah.
And the audience doesn't bring it. The act doesn't bring it. The room might have it before you're there. And I think it does. You know, a purpose-built room especially. That's what I love, is because you'll feel it right away, and you just follow it. Now, I don't know. I'm not... in Fish, of course.
Ah, sure you are. But I think, you're halfway there. Fishman.
I think it's true, though, isn't it? Right? I mean, you can feel that room before it's full, and that's the heart of it. It's why they have the ghost light to keep the ghosts of previous performances off the stage so they don't interfere.
I'll tell you what. We're probably about at the end of our hour. I'm going to say this to go come full circle. You were talking about the little riff from the barn when we started this conversation.
Yeah.
And I sent you a more recent one, but this I sent it to you a year or two ago, and you just stumbled on it. And what it is,
the looping?
We were composing bass parts for Flat Top and other songs. But in Flat Top, there was one moment where Jared and I thought, well, let's have three basses play at once for 13 beats. And... no one will notice.
Yep.
Won't be able to really. Maybe it's the perfect thing, I could do it by playing more than one note at a time, or which I can't do. But anyway, and we made a loop out of it. It's a 13 beat pattern.
Yeah.
And what I love about it is I don't understand it. I can't hear the one. It twists my brain. I'm notorious for not hearing things correctly. Like the Charlie Brown theme on the piano, I learned it backwards, left hand to right hand backwards. The guys in Fish thought that was so funny because it makes their brain into a pretzel to hear how I've always heard it. I hear things backwards, and I love that, actually. So maybe that 13-bit pattern, for me, it's actually the little nugget, the little glimpse that could be our next venture, because it's this unexpected swirling that if we could go into the studio, my fantasy, if we could, and if we had time to, and we don't have to, because I'm just riding the wave of noon a long way. But to create these moments that we don't understand, that are just pure sock, that are swirling, and just write from that. We don't have to write, we don't have to be in the same room. We can look at our own notebooks and whatever. But to create entirely together and bring no material, but find the stuff that's so hard to find, because it does take a few hours sometimes, and just let it be like a babbling brook the entire time.
What that sounds to me like, having heard the loop now 8 million times, because I can't get enough of it, is we're bringing in the studio itself. So we're going to be taking advantage of the time things you can do, not simply looping either.
Right,
Using it to...
the medium.
Yeah, make it another instrument.
Yeah,
and I think
exactly.
That's a great idea.
Exactly, I would love that. That's a great way to say it too. The studio is its own.
Yeah,
just respecting that's the context you're in. Well, it's been really great to talk about some of the things that we don't always shoot the shit about.
We don't. Yeah. We haven't really gone through this, and I once again feel like I do all the talking.
No, I'm perfectly happy. I don't feel that.
I dreaded this, actually. Mm-hmm. I thought, oh, we're going to sit down and pretend to have a conversation. Well, it doesn't work that way. It actually happened, doesn't it? I mean, did you feel that way at all?
I was just looking forward to it. I knew, but I know what you mean.
At first
I thought we would have someone interviewing us the whole time and that would be cool. And then when I realized it was going to be just the two of us, I thought, oh, well, we do that anyway.
Yeah.
Why do we need
all
to
all I could think of was 1, 2, 3, converse.
Yeah, right.
That's what I was expecting.
Or 1, 2, 3, contrive.
Yes.
Wait, that should be the name of the next album. 1, 2, 3, Contrive.
Very good. That okay. And Miller Dying, those two.
And Miller Dying. We have some good, yes.
Yeah.
Well, if anyone wants to advance purchase the next album, 1, 2, 3, Contrive, a.k.a. Miller Dying, then send us some money and we'll send you a promise.
Agreed.
Leo Kottke, Mike Gordon, thank you so much for joining us here on the Talkhouse podcast. You guys are some of the sickest musicians to ever grace these airwaves. Make sure to subscribe to the Talkhouse podcast to catch future episodes like Phoebe Bridgers in conversation with Betty Levette.
What?
And a Jeff Tweedy twofer. One conversation with Nora Jones, the other with Nick Offerman. You do not want to miss these.
Check out Talkhouse on all your favorite social channels. Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, we got them all.
For today's talk, Leo was recorded by Miles Hansen at Creation Audio, and Mike was recorded by none other than Jared Slomoff himself. The Talkhouse podcast producer is Mark Yoshizumi. Today's show had additional engineering by Katie Lau, and our researcher is Reese Higgins.
The Talkhouse podcast theme was composed and performed by The Range.
Till next week, I'm Ellie Einhorn.
I'm Josh Modell.
Peace. And finger style.
Ooh, close.
We tried.